Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. My co-host Grace Wan is off for the night, but you'll hear her later in the show interviewing the San Francisco Chronicle's food critic, Salil Ho. We'll also be discussing Elon Musk's purchase of the social media platform Twitter and what that may mean for the Bay Area. But first, what role could California play in a post-Roe America? According to a draft majority opinion authored by Justice Samuel Alito and leaked to Politico, the Supreme Court plans to roll back the constitutional right to an abortion in the United States nearly 50 years after the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. State lawmakers here in California lost no time last week in announcing our state would become a haven for reproductive freedom if Roe v. Wade is actually overturned. But the state did not stop there. Governor Newsom and others have proposed an amendment to California's constitution to protect reproductive rights, and the state's legislative women's caucus is introducing laws to both strengthen and expand access to abortion. So here to help us unpack what California is doing to safeguard reproductive rights, we're so pleased to be joined by Shannon Olivieri Hovis, who is the director of NARAL Pro-Choice California. Welcome to State of the Bay, Shannon.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Shannon, if the Supreme Court decides to reverse Roe versus Wade, and we should emphasize this is a draft opinion, we don't know what the final vote is going to be like, but let's say it is going to be as this leaked draft majority opinion suggests, what does that mean for the future of abortion rights and access in the United States?
Well, certainly the shocking leak of a draft opinion in this case is the most alarming and ominous sign yet of what's to come for the future of abortion rights and access in the United States. And I do want to emphasize the point you just made that it is a draft opinion and abortion is still legal in this country. But it also is clear that the Supreme Court appears poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, ending the nearly 50-year constitutional right to abortion and allowing states to ban abortion, which we expect 28 states to do following the ruling. So that's, I want to say that again, more than half of the United States, we expect to ban almost entirely or entirely the right to abortion care in their states.
Mm-hmm. But here in California, abortion rights would not change, correct?
That's right. So we have a statutory protection to the right to reproductive freedom, to abortion care in this state. And then we also actually have our California Supreme Court did find that there is a right to abortion within the California state constitution embedded in our right to privacy. And that ruling, funny enough, was actually 4 years before the decision in Roe v. Wade. So it's been longstanding to have found a right to abortion care within the right to privacy.
And Shannon, you mentioned 28 states may end up banning abortion. But who are the types of people who are going to be most impacted by this reversal? I mean, it's not necessarily half the population, correct? And it's not even necessarily everyone within those states who might have means to evade a ban, correct?
Of course. I mean, like everything, unfortunately, we are going to see that the most vulnerable, most marginalized, those who do not traditionally have access to healthcare, to money, right? Those who are, we're talking about Black, Indigenous, other people of color, LGBTQ folks will be more vulnerable, certainly immigrant populations, people with low incomes. You know, the list sort of goes on and on as far as who's at greatest risk here. And, you know, one of the things I think is worth mentioning is, you know, people conjure up these notions of what a pre-Roe world looked like, but a post-Roe world will actually look quite different because we have, you know, advancements in medical science and technology. We have medication abortion, which is completely, it's very, very, very safe and can be administered at home. And so it's, you know, some of the imagery that we think of in a pre-Roe world doesn't apply here. But one of the big concerns is that there is really the legal landscape and that we could find women in the United States and pregnant people in the United States actually being put behind bars for accessing abortion care, because there are some questions to ask here, right? How are these abortion bans going to be enforced? Will people actually be thrown in jail for having an abortion? Well, then what about a miscarriage? You can't differentiate between abortion and a miscarriage early on in pregnancy. And then what kind of interrogation would somebody be subjected to in order to investigate a pregnancy that's ended? It really means that any pregnancy outcome, any pregnancy loss could be the subject of an interrogation. And that is a really just a frightening and alarming prospect that we have to look at.
And I assume we'll have a range of enforcement regimes across these states if this draft decision does become final. But you did mention medication for abortion that can be taken safely at home. Is that going to be a viable way for women and other pregnant people in these states that outlaw abortion to be able to obtain one, even if there aren't any clinics available to them?
Yes. I mean, certainly. What I would recommend even for folks right now is go online, order medication abortion. If there's telehealth in your state, it makes it much easier to do that. But even there are ways around it if there's a restriction in your state on telehealth for medication abortion. And have it in your medicine cabinet. Have it on hand so that if you need it, if a friend needs it, you're able to help right away. The reality is that medication abortion is safer than Tylenol. It is something that we should just have on hand. Don't stock it up, but have it on hand.
Mm-hmm. And I know states are going to move, presumably, to criminalize taking medication abortion. Is that going to be plausible? Can they really crack down on the use of medication?
Many states already have bans on medication abortion, and it's really to what I just spoke to, which is this concern that instead of, you know, yes, it is true that abortion will become less safe, but it will also become, I mean, the vision that we should have is people in handcuffs, not coat hangers. And it's, mm-hmm. I mean, the people in handcuffs thing should be extra alarming to folks here. One of the bills that we're working on this year in California would actually ensure that no one in the state of California is investigated, prosecuted, or incarcerated for a pregnancy loss or for ending a pregnancy. We need to make extra clear that having a miscarriage, having a stillbirth, accessing abortion care, these things are not crimes and should not be treated as such.
Mm-hmm. And Governor Newsom and other California lawmakers have said that the state is going to be a haven for reproductive freedom. So what does that mean legislatively and in practice?
California, so Governor Newsom announced that California was a reproductive freedom state back in 2019, actually, to his credit. And the legislature has really affirmed that as well. So what it means for us to be a reproductive freedom state is that we are truly able to get rid of, to do away with the persistent barriers that exist to accessing care in this state, and that we can accommodate all patients, all people that need access to abortion care and other reproductive health care, both for Californians and for what is bound to be a significant influx of folks who need to access care here. Mm-hmm. We created in last fall of 2021, we created the California Future of Abortion Council. And the purpose of that council was in anticipation of the Supreme Court unraveling the legal right to abortion, the constitutional right to abortion. We really wanted to look at our existing infrastructure in California. It really surprises people to learn that 40% of California counties do not actually have an abortion provider. And we have significant provider shortages. A handful of counties here don't have a single OBGYN. Mm-hmm. So if we are going to truly become a reproductive freedom state, we need to look at our existing barriers. We need to look at, our provider shortages. We need to look at how people can and cannot access care. I mean, a lot of the issues that people have, the cost of abortion itself, cost is the biggest barrier that folks face when trying to access abortion care. But even other logistical supports, like if they have to travel far distances or they need childcare or they need help with overnight lodging, if for some reason they end up having a multi-day procedure, you know, there can be any number of things that we need to account for. And in California, we're trying to ensure that we are truly a reproductive freedom state for all people, for all Californians, and for all who may need us.
Mm-hmm. Well, based on what you said, it sounds like this influx of people that may be flocking to the state for reproductive health choices and services, we may not be well prepared for that influx. And I'm wondering if you have any indication so far of what's happened in the state, given the experience in Texas, where their state law SB8 went into effect, which essentially has criminal penalties for anyone who gets an abortion or helps provide services for an abortion. Have we seen an uptick of people from out of state, from Texas, coming here to obtain reproductive health services?
We definitely have seen an uptick in out-of-state patients, and some of that's a little bit hard to track. One thing that's also worth mentioning is Access Reproductive Justice, which is the only statewide abortion fund in California. They've certainly seen an increase in callers from out of state who are seeking their guidance and financial and logistical assistance. I think it's also worth mentioning, though, that abortion in California, abortion care in California currently comprises 17% of all abortions in the United States. So we are a significant source of providing care already. And it's also true that here in California, about one in four facilities that provide abortion care in the entire country are actually located within California. And you can imagine that as states ban abortion, the number of facilities that provide abortion care across the country is going to drop significantly. And so California, what percentage then will we maintain here of the facilities that offer abortion care? We're going to see the math play out, and it's going to be pretty astonishing. The Guttmacher Institute did an analysis of this, and what they found is that California, if Roe does fall and the right to abortion goes back to the states, and we see the 28 states, like I mentioned, ban abortion care, an additional 1.4 million women of reproductive age would find that their nearest abortion clinic is in the state of California. Now, most of those folks would be coming from Arizona. It's also important to keep in mind that in many instances, somebody, for example, who's in Dallas will actually find it easier, more efficient in time and everything else to get on a plane from Dallas to Los Angeles than to drive, for example, to Colorado. Mm-hmm. So we don't know exactly what this landscape is going to look like yet, but we have to be as prepared as possible. And we have an opportunity, from my perspective, we have an opportunity and also an obligation as the fifth largest economy in the country. I mean, in the world, I'm sorry, to really provide the care to folks who are going to be just desperate having this constitutional right stripped from them.
Well, and it seems like it's even more challenging because here in California, we've set a goal that starting in 2023, next year, all abortion-related services are supposed to be free. So how is the state going to plan for this influx?
We're preparing in so many different ways. I mean, this year we're sponsoring the California Future of Abortion Council has a 13-bill legislative package, and that legislative package looks at how to address cost barriers and ensure we have adequate reimbursement for abortion and abortion-related services for our provider network. It ensures that we have that we're able to provide additional direct practical support to patients seeking abortion care. We have a bill that is specifically geared toward addressing California's provider shortages. We actually have a couple of those. For example, in California, it's not just physicians who are authorized to provide abortion care. Nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and certified nurse midwives can also provide abortion care in California. Well, how do we make sure that they, in the first trimester, I should specify. So how do we ensure that they're actually able to do that? That it's not just a legal authorization, but that they have the adequate training to do so, that we're really opening doors to ensure that that pipeline is there. And one of the bills, for example, that's being worked on this year will ensure that nurse practitioners can provide abortion care without physician supervision. Again, they're already authorized. If they have adequate training, they might be the only provider who could provide care in some of the remote parts of the state. You know, not all of our clinics in Reading or wherever it may have a physician on staff full time. So how can we increase access in all of these different varieties of ways? So I don't want to say that California is not ready. We've been preparing for a long time, and I'm really proud that we truly are leading the way. The report that the California Future of Abortion Council put out in December has 45 policy recommendations, and we've seen other blue states like ours really take to that and start passing a lot of the recommendations that we put forth in their own states already this year. So we are ramping up, but it's ramping up.
So you mentioned this legislation around nurse practitioners. I'm curious if there's other key legislation or constitutional amendments that's being proposed by the governor and others that we should be keeping an eye on. What are some of the other measures you want to mention?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning for folks to look up the California Future of Abortion Council. You can see our full bill list there. And one of the things that you can do to help us really is help us pass that package this year. That is a critical piece to ensuring that California is ready to meet this moment. There are other things that folks can do too. I know so many Californians feel this incredible anxiety, and rightfully so. I mean, it gives me hives, I feel like, the idea that I have a 5-month-old daughter and, you know, I grew up knowing that the right to legal abortion, the right to make personal decisions about pregnancy and about our reproductive lives and futures was ours, right? It sat with us, and it horrifies me, the notion that my daughter is going to grow up in a world and in a country where, you know, she has fewer rights than I do. But I think that we need to not be done here, right? My hope mm-hmm. is that this rock bottom of sorts actually really compels people to make clear that we are more than the majority. We are the consensus in this country. 8 in 10 Americans support the legal right to abortion. And that's not just a majority. It truly is a consensus. And so we need to act like the consensus.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here in California, is there political support for some of the legislative changes that you're talking about and potentially a constitutional amendment to enshrine abortion right in California?
Yeah, I think the constitutional amendment is an important piece to really just, like I said, we do have a constitutional right within our right to privacy, but this makes clear that reproductive freedom, that the right to abortion, right, that's what the constitutional amendment that the governor and the Senate pro tem and the assembly speaker are proposing, that's what it would do, is really enshrine within our constitution, specifically by naming it, that we have a right to reproductive freedom, that we have a right to make our own choices about our reproductive lives and futures, and the right to abortion, right? So that it takes our protections here even further. But we have a lot of opportunities right now. And one I want to mention is Congress. So Senator, our Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, he announced at the end of last week that the Senate, the U.S. Senate, will be voting again this week on the Women's Health Protection Act. And that's an important thing, right? This would enshrine a federal legislative protection as it relates to the right to abortion in this country. So even if Roe falls, the right to abortion would stand. And we should not give up on passing that, especially because, and NARAL is a political organization, I should mention that, we have the opportunity to potentially gain seats in the U.S. Senate this year. So if we're able to hold the House, gain the seats that we need in the Senate, if we could pass the Women's Health Protection Act, we wouldn't have to see this unbelievable and horrifying unraveling of abortion rights all across the country.
Well, Shannon, we're out of time, but just real quick, when will we hear from the Supreme Court on their final decision?
We expect the final decision to come down around the end of June, at the end of their cycle. And I would just encourage folks not to take this and, you know, as final. We need to be loud. We need to be making as much noise as we possibly can. And the Supreme Court needs to hear from the American people that this is not what we want to see. This is not the future we want for our country.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. We'll have to see what happens in June and follow this legislation in the meantime that you've just been describing. But thank you so much for joining us here. Shannon Olivieri Hovis, Director of NARAL Pro-Choice California. Thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you, Ethan.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, what does Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter mean for the Bay Area? That's next after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. On April 25th, the world's richest man, Tesla co-founder and CEO Elon Musk, purchased the social media platform Twitter for a mere $44 billion, a move which generated questions not only about what impact the self-proclaimed free speech absolutist may have on Twitter's users, but also what this acquisition may mean for San Francisco and the surrounding Bay Area. So here to explore the potential consequences of this deal for Twitter employees and for San Francisco's mid-market area in particular are Emily Birnbaum, a tech lobbying and influence reporter for Politico. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We're glad you can join us. And also, we're joined by Laura Waxman, real estate and economic development reporter with the San Francisco Business Times. Welcome, Laura.
Good evening. Thanks for having me as well. Happy to be here.
Great. Glad to have the two of you. And we're also going to open up the phone lines early to hear from you, our listeners. Are you a current or former employee of Twitter? What are your thoughts on this acquisition? Or do you live and work around San Francisco's mid-market? What concerns do you have for the neighborhood if Musk ends up purchasing Twitter? So give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay, or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Emily, let's start with you. Can you just remind us of the broad strokes of this deal? What does Elon Musk plan to do once he assumes control of Twitter?
Right. As you said, Elon Musk has bought Twitter for $44 billion. He's recently released a bit more information about where that financing is coming from. He has pitched to investors that he is going to make Twitter profitable. He plans to cut Twitter's reliance on advertising, create a more subscription-based revenue. And he's said multiple times that he wants to return Twitter to its original intention, the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. And he wants... Twitter has for years been building this very complex and very intentional set of content moderation guidelines, rules for speech and hate speech and misinformation on the platform. Elon Musk has said he basically wants to throw all of that out and make it so the only kind of speech that can't be on Twitter is the speech that is illegal in the country where Twitter is operating. So overall, he wants to create a more profitable Twitter with fewer policy-related employees, it's come out in recent days that he plans to serve as temporary CEO before he chooses someone else to fill that role.
And Emily, we're in such a polarized society. Did it seem like the left or the right, reacted more negatively or positively to this news from what you could tell?
Yeah, the Republican Party has really taken on Elon Musk as sort of a free speech mascot since the news of his acquisition broke. Elon Musk has been traditionally, his politics are sort of all over the place. I don't think they could be called Republican or conservative, maybe something more like libertarian. But over the years, he has angered and aggrieved people on both sides of the aisle. But now Republicans have really taken Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter and said, look, like, this is the guy who's got it right. They have this anxiety that is really popular for campaign messaging. These social media platforms censor us. Mark Zuckerberg censors us. Google censors us. And Elon Musk is going to be the guy to create a platform where we're not censored. And Democrats have responded in kind, saying they're concerned about the rise of hate speech, abuse on Twitter, and in particular, the potential that Trump will be allowed back on the platform once Elon Musk takes control, which he's indicated he would allow.
Mm-hmm. And Emily Birnbaum, just to stay with you closer to home here, how are Twitter employees, how do they seem to be responding, at least initially here, to the news of Musk's purchase?
In speaking to Twitter employees over the last couple of weeks, I've just heard a lot of confusion. People feel that they were left totally in the dark as Elon Musk was buying up more and more stock, which is, you know, where this all began. And they feel continually like leadership doesn't really have good answers for them because this is a situation so much in flux. I think there's a lot of frustration, you know, what is this going to mean for our compensation? What is this going to mean for our work from home policy? And at a more philosophical level, what is this going to mean for the direction of Twitter? You know, a lot of people at Twitter have been involved. They've really felt they were at the forefront of creating nuanced speech policies that they were going, they were leading the way on some of these thornier questions. And, you know, now what happens to all of that work? I think it's been very emotional. There's been, you know, crying and sort of a feeling of malaise, particularly because while this deal goes forward, they're not allowed to make any big changes to the platform. So they're kind of in this pause period that is very uncomfortable.
And some have speculated that, Emily, there might be a mass exodus. What are you hearing on that? Or could there potentially be mass layoffs? Are there people concerned about losing their jobs if they're not walking away from them?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that lots of people, particularly in the policy and legal shops at Twitter, are considering leaving or are anticipating, you know, what would happen if they were laid off. Elon Musk has made it really clear that he wants to reorient Twitter. I think he said, you know, himself, towards more engineering, less of the policy and legalistic side of things. So it's particularly those people who fear for the future of their jobs. You know, he has gone after several Twitter executives already, including Twitter's top lawyer, Vijaya Gadde. And he has implied that she would not have a future at the company. And that's something that she has said to people who are close to her and, you know, basically said she's definitely concerned about the future of her teams, but, you know, that she intends to stay there and fight for their jobs as long as she can. But there's definitely layoffs of hundreds of people coming. We know that for a fact. And beefing up on the engineering side of things if Elon gets his way.
And certainly, if Tesla's any indication of how Musk runs companies, we've seen a lot of turnover there. So that might be in store for Twitter. But Laura Waxman from the San Francisco Business Times, I wanted to bring you into the conversation here. So can you just remind listeners here of the circumstances that led to Twitter moving into the mid-market area back in 2012? Because it really has transformed. Well, that's a question for you. Has it transformed the neighborhood? But let's describe a bit about how it came about in the first place 10 years ago.
Definitely. Hi. Yeah, such a fascinating issue and great insight from Emily. So if you were here back then, you might remember that this tax break was really controversial. So Twitter is a San Francisco company, and they began setting up shop right after this tax break was implemented in 2012. So it was the first company.
It's hard to cut you off, but it was a corporate tax break, correct?
Exactly.
For Twitter?
And yes. And so the city offered a temporary exemption on its 1.5% payroll tax, and Twitter was the first to make use of this and move into mid-market. And the idea was, you know, that so backtracking, Twitter had kind of threatened to leave the city because of the high taxes, and they were looking at San Mateo County to relocate. And so in order to keep Twitter here, local, the city, you know, they negotiated this deal to keep them from leaving. And the idea behind that was also to incentivize other companies to set up shop in mid-market, to revitalize the area there. It had been suffering from vacancies, and there were a lot of issues in mid-market, so that was the plan.
Mm-hmm. And did it reinvigorate the neighborhood? I mean, I've certainly seen a lot of changes in mid-market, but can we credit that or attribute that to Twitter as the people who were backing that original tax break were hoping would happen?
Definitely. So, I do think, and I think a lot of people think, that tech definitely had a huge impact on mid-market. It made it a place where people wanted to work and live. There were thousands of units that were built in the wake of Twitter and all these other companies like Square and Zendesk moving in. So, of course, you know, it did spur economic growth and investment from both the companies and the employees who were there. As I mentioned earlier, you know, 1 in 3 storefronts were counted as vacant before this tax break, and that was reduced a bit afterwards, although the pandemic has kind of thrown that out the window as well. But yeah, so, you know, it did do its job in terms of bringing investment into the neighborhood. However, there were still issues that remained. Vacancies are still a thing. The Twitter came and built a cafeteria for its employees. So the promise of employees moving into the neighborhood and then, you know, going to the sandwich shops and going to the little markets there and really frequenting the local businesses, that didn't happen.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind. And tonight we're talking about Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter and its potential impact on the Bay. We want to hear from you. What are your concerns for Bay Area real estate and our economy if this deal with Elon Musk goes through? Are you a former or current employee at Twitter? What are your thoughts on Musk's plans here? Will he keep the company in the Bay Area? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And we're discussing this topic with Emily Birnbaum, a tech lobbying and influence reporter for Politico, and Laura Waxman, real estate and economic development reporter with the San Francisco Business Times. So, Laura, just to get back to you on this question of Twitter's impact on mid-market, since the pandemic, Twitter's employees have had the option to work from home. I believe that's been in place since May of 2020. So has Twitter still had this impact on mid-market, given that, you know, presumably their employees really aren't there anymore?
Right. So this has been an interesting discussion that I've had with some of my sources. And of course, you know, mid-market losing a tenant like Twitter would be a huge deal. It would be a big loss to a market that's already sliding. The vacancy rate in the mid-market area is about 30% right now. Compared to citywide, it's about 22% for office space. So it would have a huge impact. But as you just mentioned, employees have been working from home, and at best, maybe 10% of the workforce has been in the office throughout the pandemic. So there really hasn't been any, you know, there haven't been any bodies there, for lack of better words. So the best thing, you know, that some of my sources are saying could happen would be, in an optimistic scenario, you know, the deal closes and these employees do end up being ordered back to work.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Frank dialing in from San Francisco. Frank, welcome to State of the Bay.
Oh, thank you. I want to pick a bone with this idea that he's a so-called free speech absolutist. There are free speech absolutists. I am one. I don't think Donald Trump should have been banned from Twitter, as bad as his output is. Kyle Kalinske from Secular Talk, free speech absolutist. I wouldn't call Musk a so-called free speech absolutist. I'd call him a self-proclaimed free speech absolutist. I remember when there were some young children caught in a mine, and evidently, the person
was in a cave in Thailand. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Frank, I'm curious if you have a question based on that for either of our guests, or is it just a comment that you don't believe he's truly invested in free speech?
Well, I just heard him called so-called, and there is such a thing as being a free speech absolutist. You know, when the actual rescuer said something mean to Musk about, you know, because Musk was like getting up and saying, "I'm going to bring a submarine or something," and then the poor fellow had to apologize to Musk for some reason. And I view the money is power, and Elon Musk has a lot of it. Musk financed Kanye West's, I believe, he financed Kanye West's petition to get signatures to get on the ballot. It's just to steal votes from Biden, and it's not about being a libertarian. You know,
Frank, I appreciate you bringing up your perspective. And as you know, we did say he was a self-described free speech absolutist, but we know that's obviously in the eye of the beholder to some extent. But Emily, on this point, you know, this is going to be a really challenging issue for Twitter to have to navigate what is free speech and what is not. Elon Musk is not a lawyer, not a free speech expert at the very least. So do you think anything's actually going to change? I mean, this is an issue that all the social media companies are wrestling with. Do you think that he's actually going to be able to innovate some new process or transparency that's going to, you know, truly foster free speech on these platforms?
What I've heard from a lot of content moderation experts over the last couple of weeks is he is about to have to face reality really fast. these questions are so difficult to navigate. You know, Facebook and YouTube have been trying to answer, you know, how do we protect users and protect free speech at the same time for years. And they have they've gotten unbelievable congressional scrutiny over the decisions that they've made. So, you know, Elon Musk has some ideas. He says maybe we could open up the algorithms for researchers to take a look at. Maybe we should just get rid of all content moderation guidelines all at once. But he's going to end up at the same place that Twitter did. Twitter, its origins of, you know, dealing with the issues of harassment and abuse was Gamergate, when a lot of, you know, people on the internet targeted some female journalists over their coverage of video game culture. And, you know, those women were doxxed, they were harassed, and Twitter had to step in and try to figure out what are we going to do here? Because, you know, is free speech, you know, does abuse affect, you know, people's ability to speak freely, basically. So at this point, these are really thorny questions. And he's almost, you know, going back in time. You know, this is a very old sort of, like, in the heyday of the Silicon Valley startup. This was the idea. This was Mark Zuckerberg's idea, what he was trying to achieve. And we've just grown and learned a lot since then. And it's very unlikely he's going to be able to enact the vision that he's putting out right now.
Mm-hmm. And Emily Birnbaum, I had asked you earlier about the morale and the mood at Twitter and what you're hearing from employees. And I'm wondering about how employees of color are perceiving this, given that Tesla has faced a wave of racial discrimination claims and a lawsuit from the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing after receiving hundreds of complaints from Tesla employees alleging that the Fremont plant where the Teslas are manufactured is a racially segregated workplace where black workers are subjected to racial slurs and discriminated against. So is this translating to the Twitter employees of color? Are they particularly worried about that?
Yes, I think that's a deep anxiety. That's, you know, it's scary. It's scary to read that lawsuit, to hear the horrific stories of abuse of black employees at Tesla. Twitter has positioned itself as this sort of socially aware, diversity forward company over the last couple of years. It hasn't been, you know, Facebook, for instance, has been somewhat subject to these complaints by conservatives, that they are, you know, they're too liberal. They don't listen to Republicans. And Twitter has gotten the same complaints, but they've sort of leaned to this image. You know, we stand for diversity. They, under Jack Dorsey's leadership, they created this really interesting team, that basically, mainly made of women of color, that basically they're trying to use technology to make conversation healthier. You know, how do you design ethical algorithms? How do you make your products ethical from the very start? That's the question that they were exploring. And, you know, a lot of people are concerned about the future of that team, and about the future of people who work on questions around, you know, race-based harassment. I think that there's a deep anxiety. Twitter, I've said this for a while, Twitter employees, of all the companies that I cover, because I cover the 10 companies, they love their workplace so much. Like, they are more devoted and loyal than most any other, you know, company that I deal with regularly. And this is obviously going to be very disruptive, particularly for women and people of color, who are personally affected by a lot of these mm-hmm. decisions.
Well, and Emily Birnbaum from Politico, I'm curious what else we know about Musk's leadership style. And I just have to quote from a tweet that he put out saying that if Twitter acquisition is complete, the company will be super focused on hardcore software engineering, design, and server hardware, and I strongly believe that all managers in a technical area must be technically excellent. Managers in software must write great software, or it's like being a cavalry captain who can't ride a horse. And he went on to add, the work ethic expectations would be extreme, but much less than I demand of myself. And of course, he's somewhat famous for basically sleeping in a sleeping bag on the factory floor at Tesla to get the Model 3 production going. So based on this, what are you hearing in terms of his leadership style and what Twitter employees and Twitter users might expect?
I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks talking to people who have worked with Elon Musk in Washington specifically, or who have worked on his government affairs or policy teams at SpaceX and Tesla. And, you know, all of them say he has a very sharp-elbowed approach to dealing with government and dealing with his own employees. He's very quick to fire people who he feels are underperforming. He's very involved in the minutiae, sort of, I guess you would say he's maybe micromanages, you know, if there are particular projects he cares about, then he often will step in and just Bigfoot his government affairs teams, you know, reach out to regulators himself, or he will just simply make announcements that run over what the policy team has been working on. So I think the fear is that he leads with aggression. He leads, he said, by instinct. And that makes his companies sort of volatile to work at. And he has really high exacting standards. And he's not afraid to just fire a bunch of people if he is unhappy with the output he's getting, which is so drastically different than the Twitter we know today, where it's very community based, you know, even sort of familial.
Yeah. So Laura Waxman, real estate economic development reporter for the San Francisco Business Times, we're hearing that he might have plans to relocate Twitter to Texas. Musk himself has personally left the Bay Area and moved the headquarters of Tesla, his Boring company, SpaceX, there to that state. So are there any official plans to relocate Twitter at this point?
Right. So nothing official yet. But, you know, of course, there's a lot of speculation. And we know that Elon Musk is not a fan of remote work. He's made that very clear. So, you know, if he were to relocate Twitter, I'm sure the employees would have to follow, mm-hmm. and which would have a big impact on of course, you know, as we talked about, on the city, because a lot of the employees live here as well. It's not like they're commuting on, you know, tech shuttles into the city. A lot of them live here, and so that would be a big deal.
Yeah. Well, and Laura, on this question, because I asked you earlier about a potential mass exodus or layoff, we actually had a listener write in who says a mass exodus is unlikely. So many of these employees' compensation is tied up in stocks. And even if they do leave, isn't it likely that they move to other Bay Area tech companies? So in other words, is this really going to hurt, even in the worst case scenario, is this really going to hurt the Bay Area economy or even the mid-market area if many of these employees end up staying, working for other companies and have their compensation, you know, again, as a listener wrote, tied up in stocks?
Right. And I think, you know, just because we've had this pandemic, everything is just shaken up anyways. And as we discussed earlier, mid-market in particular, you know, has not had that traffic from the employees that would usually go into the Twitter headquarters or into some of these other headquarters of other companies that are located there. So really, you know, it's whether it would make a difference at this moment, probably not. And if anything, you know, if the headquarters were to relocate, it would free up space for other companies to potentially move into that building and, you know, maybe be present or be in office or whatever. So I think as far as immediate changes or immediate impacts, we probably wouldn't feel it right away.
Although it does seem like a number of high-profile companies have either left or announced that they're leaving the city of San Francisco. Isn't that correct? I mean, it does seem like we have a bit of a trend here, right?
That's true. There have been a few that have left throughout the pandemic, and there have been some that are setting up their headquarters here or are leasing space as well. So it's kind of, you know, just really depends. But I feel like I just wrote about a company that is leasing a whole building to set up their headquarters here. The next couple of days, there was a story about another company that was giving up a building because they are consolidating. So it's just really very fluid right now. And I think a lot of employers are still working out their workplace strategies and their plans. And, you know, those who were probably already thinking about leaving before the pandemic, it may have made it easier for them to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, but I want to talk about some potential upsides here. And Emily Birnbaum of Politico, starting with you. Could this be good news for the company and the Bay Area? Elon, I mean, Twitter, for example, has not really made money like the other social media platforms have, but Musk has plans to monetize the platform. Do you think there's an upside for the health of the company and maybe for the Bay Area as a result?
Elon has very, very optimistic plans for what he can do for Twitter's revenue. You know, he says that he could quintuple the revenue. Twitter has long disliked its over-reliance on advertising, and Elon says, we're going to figure out a different way forward. And, you know, in terms of this question of Twitter employee compensation, basically managers have said, executives have said, you know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it's most likely that employees' compensation will remain largely the same. Their stock options will convert to cash when the deal with Musk closes, and employees are going to receive their same benefits packages for at least a year. So I guess in terms of what it could be, it could lead to a much more profitable Twitter. But it also is possible that, you know, he is dreaming too big or overpromising, which is something that he has a history of doing as well. There's also, you know, we were talking a lot about this mass exodus, you know, are Twitter employees going to leave? But, you know, another thing we're seeing is that it's possible there might be a whole new stream of employees coming in who are, you know, in favor of his vision.
In an influx, absolutely. We only have 30 seconds left, so I'm just going to get the last question. Same question to you, Laura Waxman. Any upsides here for the Bay Area that you could see? Do we still have Laura?
Yes. Hello. Yes. So as far as Elon Musk and Twitter, you know, the upside obviously with him taking over this company and potentially workers coming back to the office. I mean, that would set a tone for other companies as well, as I mentioned, who are still contemplating their workplace strategies and aren't sure whether to bring employees back full-time or into a hybrid model. I do think that that would set a tone for a lot of other companies to follow.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, Emily Birnbaum of Politico and Laura Waxman of the San Francisco Business Times. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear my co-host Grace Wan's interview with San Francisco Chronicle food critic Solil Ho. Stay tuned.
Solil Ho has been the restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle since 2019. A self-described writer on the fish sauce beat, Solil has been praised for revolutionizing the world of restaurant and food criticism by focusing on food as a lens for tackling important issues like race, class, and gender. Earlier this month, they were named a finalist for this year's James Beard Restaurant Review Award. Solil Ho, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you on the show, and you've only been at the Chronicle for a few years, but you're already like a San Francisco institution. I mean, I always read your restaurant reviews. And I mentioned in the intro that you call yourself, quote, a writer on the fish sauce beat. Why'd you choose that moniker for yourself?
I'm really bad at describing myself in general. I think most people are, right? It's hard. And I had written that on my website, actually, at a time when I was writing a lot about Vietnamese food. And so that kind of felt really natural. So for a while, it felt like there were only maybe one or two other Vietnamese food writers out there in the U.S. And so it felt very much like a beat.
It's a great one. And I wanted to ask you a question that you asked Ruth Reichel, the iconic New York Times food critic, when you interviewed her in 2019. And that question was, what did you feel you needed to change when you started writing reviews?
Yeah, good question. You know, for her, it was quite a bit of things, but for me, when I really got into food writing, which was around 2015 to 2018, the food media world was only just beginning to think about and consider seriously the idea that food is political. And like now it feels kind of trite to say that, but it wasn't always like this. And I I had such a hard time really grasping why a lot of legacy publications were so hesitant to embrace that idea that, like, you can write about immigration, you can write about labor and politics and, like, unions and wages and all of that stuff in a food publication, and it still has to do with food. And I think a lot of times people who really don't like my writing, which is fine, you don't have to like my writing. But I think people who don't really get it feel like I'm putting politics into food writing, whereas really it's been a cover up. Let's be honest.
Right.
It's been a long running denial. I'm just not denying it.
Well, I think, you know, it's this idea that when we gather around a table to have a meal and a conversation, we're talking about meaningful things. And I think that's something that you bring to your writing.
I think there's this idea, which is food brings us together, brings disparate peoples together. But I think in so many ways, food is a denominator of difference, right? It does differentiate us from other people. Anyone who has had their food criticized at the workplace or at school can tell you that. Anyone who has, you know, not been able to afford a meal can tell you that. All of that is still a part of the experience of food.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go back to your work as a Chronicle restaurant critic. One of the first things you did was eliminate star ratings. Why are those a problem?
I don't think there's a problem per se. I think that's not very useful for what I want to do, I guess, to clarify. I wanted to write things that were more nuanced and just more inclusive of, like, many kinds of restaurants, you know? And to me, the star rating was very much like the SATs, right? A standardized test, where it's less about whether or not someone is smart and more about, are they good at taking tests, right? Mm-hmm. And for something so holistic as a restaurant review, it just didn't make sense. And then there's the baggage that Michelin stars hold, right? Mm. People will suffer and make others suffer in service of gaining stars. And I just didn't want to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. And although you did away with star ratings, you continue to have a best new restaurant list, but yours is really eclectic. It has pop-ups, a grocery store, cafe, a municipal market. What makes a food establishment worth highlighting?
Oh man, that's a good question. For me, there's a specialness. There's this something else there that strikes me when I go there, where it feels like there's a story, there's something exceptional going on. Someone's trying really hard or trying to educate or holding it down for their community in a way that is exciting and, like, novel and true. Often I think about, like, okay, what is this saying about what it means to eat here now? And if there's something, if they're saying something, then great.
Right, you're right, that ability to say something. I wanted to congratulate you on being named a finalist for the James Beard Restaurant Critic Award. And I just loved the eclecticism behind the reviews that were nominated here. One was about a $72 viral fried rice. Another one was about Impossible Nuggets. And a third was about Smash Burgers. Is that kind of representative of your writing? It's such a big breadth of topics. And also kind of they tickle the brain.
Yeah. So each of them, I thought, had something else to say beyond food. Of course, like, food was an integral part of it. The fried rice thing was sort of this Faustian story about a chef who dared to put something, like, really wacky and gold flaked on the menu and just got bit in the butt over it. Because then he had to make it all of a sudden. It was like a true monkey's paw kind of thing, right?
Yes, yes.
And then the Smashburger story was about a pop-up that's put on by a guy with a normal day job, but he's depressed. And the only way he can really combat that is making Smashburgers.
I support that. I think
it's a very human story. Mm. Yeah. And the Impossible Nuggets one was really about the strangeness of simulating something that we don't really eat for its chickenness anyway.
I know. I mean, is it just a ketchup delivery system or a barbecue sauce delivery system? Is that what a nugget is all about? Or
there's very little chicken in a chicken nugget.
I mean, for me, you could probably fry like a shoelace and I would eat it anyway. You know, the restaurant industry has had it so hard during the pandemic. Restaurants have been closing. They're having a hard time finding staff. Do you feel any responsibility as a critic to kind of lift it up? Does it make you shy away from a critical review?
Well, I have to remember first and foremost that I serve readers. I serve people at large, right? I don't serve restaurants. So, you know, it's hard. Like from the beginning, it's been hard because I worked in restaurants. I come from that world. I have a lot of empathy for people in that world. And I think it shows through all the writing I've done on labor and on workers and and on the Paycheck Protection Program and the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. You know, I care. I've done what I can to say that restaurants need bailouts and they need money from the government in order to survive. You know, they were okay with closing for public health reasons, but they were just sort of left in the dust mostly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think if a restaurant is charging money for food, right, money for goods and services, then it's fair game.
Right, right. And another sort of pandemic-related question I had was, you know, for years your writing and other work has shown how embedded racism and oppression is in food. The pandemic also brought this rising tide of Asian American violence. And I wanted to ask you, is there an inherent irony in how this country embraces just all manner of Asian and Asian American cuisine, but can also be so hateful towards a population?
I don't see it as ironic. I see it as very appropriate for how white supremacy works. If you read Bell Hooks's Eating the Other, there's precedent for this, especially for, you know, Black Americans and many formerly enslaved people, right? Like the food of the United States is Black food. And yet it is not as if, I don't know, we are not ruled, right, by a Black majority. Mm-hmm. And the oppression of Black people, anti-Blackness, is inherent to this country. And yet we, the food is very much a part of our culture. So I just see it as part and parcel of being here.
It's like the majority of the society wanting the best of what you have to offer, but not you yourself.
Right. I mean, like, in the end, you consume food, right? Mm-hmm. It's really just like, are you willing to engage with this culture or these people beyond a transactional kind of relationship? And oftentimes, no, that's not.
Exactly. Not. Yeah. And I think that's something that your writing really focuses on. So just as we're finishing up here, what restaurants or new foods are you excited to try in the coming months? What's the next impossible nugget that we should be having on our radar?
Well, I am really excited about more sort of zero waste style restaurants like Shuggie's in San Francisco, which also is like very fun looking. And there's just all this really interesting art and color in there. But they have pizza that is very much just based on food waste, just kind of scraps and other kind of ugly produce type stuff. And I think that's really interesting. I think if you make it fun and delicious, people will come and get it. You know, I think it's so hard to sell virtue on the basis of virtue. You also have to make it pleasurable.
That's to be delicious in the end, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So I'm excited about that. And I'm excited about what that might spark in others.
Right. Nobody wants a plate of good intention. They want an impossible nugget. They want something fried. Well, we'll have to leave it there. You can find a link to Solejo's reviews and their podcast, Extra Spicy, on the State of the Bay page at kalw.org. Solejo, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, and good luck with the James Beard Awards.
Thank you. If you like chicken nuggets, then you gotta sing along. If you like chicken nuggets, this is your favorite song. If you like chicken nuggets, then you gotta sing along. If you like chicken nuggets.
Well, that made me hungry. And that's State of the Bay this week. I want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And up next week, we'll be talking with author Diana Capp about her new book, Girls Who Green the World, 34 Rebel Women Out to Save Our Planet. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney, and it was engineered by David Kwan. Joanne Marr was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.